for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Obama administration defends its secret collection of millions of Verizon phone records and data from internet companies. It's saying it's necessary to prevent terrorism. Top military leaders testified before a Senate committee on sexual assault in the armed forces, and the U.S. economy adds 175,000 jobs in May. Here with me for the Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup, Susan Page of USA Today, Major Garrett of CBS News, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post. Do join us with your phone calls to 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you all. Karen Tumulty, we've had 24 hours of dramatic disclosures, starting with The Guardian, and then The Washington Post picked it up.
Yeah, this is the story, the extent of surveillance that is, it's a real paradox because in some ways it's shocking and in some ways it's totally unsurprising. You know, we have known that in the post-9/11 world that the government had been given a lot more authority to go after what is private information about people. We saw a couple of controversies in 2006, first over domestic warrantless eavesdropping, and then secondly over the same thing, which is getting people's phone records. But a couple of, first of all, what is surprising about the story is the extent to which the Obama administration is doing this. And I do think that with, particularly with the internet, with the, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple being part of this, we now see the government is also looking not just at patterns of contacts, which is what they say they were doing with the phone records, but they are actually searching through the actual material. They are looking at emails. They are looking at, you know, Skype chats. They are looking at actual content.
And Major, what are they looking for?
They're looking for what counterterrorism experts describe as data that bumps into each other and suggests patterns that might be reflective of an emerging or an ongoing terrorist plot. The experts I spent time talking to the last 2 days about this say much of this data that is analytically sifted falls out, doesn't raise flags, doesn't go anywhere. To be clear, in the case of the phone tracking, it is not the listening into phone conversations that is going on. The names attached to the numbers are not recorded. The numbers are, the location of the calls and the duration of the calls are collected. In the case of internet traffic, it's blogs, videos, chats, emails, all these sorts of things. Much of that data falls away. But the data that is flagged is then put through algorithms to see if it does bump ever closer to known, let us say, URLs, known email addresses, Dropboxes that have been previously flagged as related to or held by terrorist suspects. And in some cases, they've allowed the United States government to thwart terrorist attacks planned here in the United States, all done through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, authorities created in the Patriot Act after 9/11, reauthorized in 2006 with different and more precise civil liberties protections and guidelines, which the Obama administration, which would have preferred all this to remain secret, says are being followed.
Susan.
Well, we should make it clear that there are two separate programs here. There's the PRISM program that involves email, Skype, those. That's a program that targets foreigners. Now, it does, they say, inadvertently or incidentally pick up information about Americans, but that's really targeting foreign interest. The one that I think is more controversial or is going to raise more eyebrows among Americans is this telephone surveillance, this massive database of what sounds like almost every phone call you make in the United States is becomes part of a big government database that can be searched after the fact. If you have a Boston bombing and you identify a suspect and he's got a phone, it enables them to go back and look at who he called, who called him. One step back from that, who called or was called by people with contact with him, second degree of separation. And that is, I think, a level of surveillance mm-hmm. of Americans who have done nothing wrong, mm-hmm. who are suspected of no wrongdoing, that raises concerns both among civil libertarians, kind of traditional liberals, and also among conservative libertarian conservatives.
So how much of a change is this in this so-called sweeping surveillance law?
Well, people like Dianne Feinstein yesterday were saying with the reports about the Verizon records, you know, look, this is an extension of the actual policy that has been going on for quite a while. And I am not yet sure what kind of political resonance this is going to have. On the one hand, again, it feels intrusive. On the other hand, however, I think people want a greater level of surveillance after 9/11. And also, there is a degree to which we have all just been accustomed to the
exactly.
idea that corporations, I mean, that's part of their business model is selling private information of us. And let's face it, you know, Amazon knows everything I read, and iTunes knows everything I listen to, and, you know, Safeway, in return for a discount card, knows everything I eat.
There is a distinction, and I think it's importantly raised by civil libertarians and those who are maybe new to the idea of civil liberties in this context, which is in commercial transactions, you are generally speaking aware of what you give and receive in a commercial transaction. In a post 9/11 world, Americans would like to know the depth and scope of surveillance designed to protect them. And there are times when it can and should be publicly debated. And disclosures like this force this into the public square in a way that those who are administering these programs now. In 48 hours, we've gone from a phone tracking system that was not widely known. And believe me, it doesn't just involve Verizon. Every major telecommunications company is involved, and this is on an ongoing, rolling basis. What we saw this week was one court order for April to July, but I guarantee you there are court orders for the months before and the months after. And so the American public would like to see more told to them about it, and we've now had some elements of that declassified, which were classified just 72 hours ago.
And here's another difference. Amazon can't put you in jail, and Safeway can't audit your taxes, but the government can. And one reason this raises such concern is a more general concern that conservatives have raised about the size and the power of government. And it goes, I think that's one reason this is an especially problematic controversy for President Obama, because that's been a line of attack against him on the Affordable Care Act and the auto bailout and on much he's done as president. This fits right in to that train of thought.
And liberals as well have raised a lot of these concerns. And this is sort of a moment in which a lot of people who used to be dismissed as paranoids, the, you know, black helicopter crowd or, you know,
sure.
as John McCain might have said, the cuckoo birds. Now this is their moment to say, I told you so.
And we are going to devote a full hour to this subject on Monday. But what I'd like to know from all of you is if the administration has indicated that some plots have been foiled because of this kind of surveillance, Susan.
Yes, Congressman Rogers, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said that a specific plot was foiled because of information from this program. And we believe that that was the plot to put explosive backpacks in the New York City subway system. So certainly last night we got this, I tell you, among the unusual emails we got last night was on the record statements from the Director of National Intelligence, Mr. Clapper, confirming the programs and defending them as things that were important to the security of Americans.
Yeah, the administration has not said specifically that this plot or that plot was thwarted.
Right.
Other members of Congress have come much closer to that. Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, so this is bipartisan, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said after a briefing on Capitol Hill about this yesterday afternoon, several plots have been thwarted because of this information.
We have a tweet picking up on what you just said, Susan. Nobody really cares about privacy anymore, but abuse of power is a different story. The NSA timing near the IRS scandal gives it salience.
So that tweeter needs to have his own column, his or her own column, because I think those are really powerful points to make.
And not just the IRS scandal, but the whole, you know, the stuff involving the Associated Press and James Rosen. I mean, there is a through line to all of these things, whether you want to call them scandals or not.
And I would just say this, Diane. There are a couple of members of the Senate who have been persistent in their questioning of the NSA and related agencies. Ron Wyden of Oregon and Mark Udall of Colorado have been sending letters probing, pushing to find out more information. They're not solely responsible for this, but there have been members of Congress before these disclosures raising questions, asking for the scope, the reach, the depth, the breadth of this surveillance to try to find out what's going on. They now know a lot more. Congress knows a lot more. And in the case of PRISM, it's important to point out, it was briefed and discussed with key and very selective members of Congress, but they were sworn to secrecy.
Well, in fact,
about their knowledge
in March, Senator Wyden, in a public hearing, asked Clapper if there was any massive data sweep for U.S. citizens, and Clapper said no. And that is a question he's going to be, I predict, called back and forced to explain to Congress about why that wasn't lying.
And semantic interpretations will be abounding.
And, of course, all of this comes as Susan Rice is named Director of National Security, and you have Samantha Power, who must go through confirmation as the appointment for her to become U.N. Ambassador. We're going to talk more about that as the hour continues. Of course, we'll take your calls. I see many of you are concerned about this issue, and we'll try to work in as many of your comments as possible. Susan Page, Major Garrett, Karen Temelty, they're all here for you. And we're back with the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup this week with Karen Temelty of The Washington Post, Major Garrett of CBS News, Susan Page of USA Today. Major, what about these national security appointments? Tom Donilon decided to step down as NSA advisor. And you've got Susan Rice, who's going to step into that program. She has been under a lot of scrutiny over the past year because of Benghazi. She does not need Senate confirmation on this. How is all this going to change foreign policy for the Obama administration?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I'm not sure I can give you a conclusive answer about how it's going to change foreign policy. Certainly, you'll have a different personality within the National Security Council, organizing and coordinating all of the agency input to the president on foreign policy and military policy matters. And that's an enormously important role the National Security Advisor plays. And Tom Donilon played it with quiet, some would say ruthless power and bureaucratic efficiency. He was very, very good at the inside game. He was often the last voice that President Obama heard before making a very big decision on military or foreign policy. He was not someone who spent a lot of time on television. He did most of his authoritative work inside the West Wing. and manage the process, which can be at times unwieldy between the Pentagon, State Department, CIA, Homeland Security, very well. This will be an organizational challenge for Susan Rice. But I can tell you this, Susan Rice has wanted this job for a long time, thinks she's been grooming herself for this job for a long time, hoped to get it in 2009 when General James Jones got it, the first national security advisor to the president. Then Tom Donilon got it, and she continued to wait her time at the UN. Then when there was the idea that she might be nominated for Secretary of State, clearly a confirmation battle in the Senate was not something the White House either wanted to wage or thought it could win. So again, she had to wait. And it was made clear to me at the White House for months that Tom Donilon would probably leave sometime this summer on his own time schedule and that Susan Rice would be the successor. So she knows and has known for some time she would be stepping into this role. She is a bit of a sharp-elbowed person at times. That has won her the favor of President Obama because of the UN. On issues like Iran sanctions and North Korea, she's been tough, aggressive, and successful, and the president likes that and wants her close at hand.
Here's one concern I've heard, though, that these are both appointments of people who are personally really close to Obama, have been with him for a long time. They're not people who will differ with him or challenge him. I mean, both of them, I think, have very strong personalities. But there's a value to the whole team of rivals approach for a president who tends to be, any president tends to operate in a bubble. So the loss of someone like Hillary Clinton, who had her own independent standing, who wasn't there thanks to Barack Obama, was there really because of her own achievements and her very, you know, her almost successful presidential campaign. I wonder if there's a kind of a loss there for President Obama in just being able to hear divergent voices within his inner circle.
And what about that?
Well, yeah. I agree. And it's not just in these national security appointments. It's up and down the line, starting with the chief of staff, Dennis McDonough. He picked somebody essentially from within the family. In terms of how it's going to change the president's worldview, I think not much, because even though, you know, Susan Rice's worldview is really shaped, I think, by what she saw in Rwanda during the Clinton years, I do think Obama's is pretty well set now. It's very much of a realist worldview. And I don't think, you know, that the sort of America's indispensable nation that these two women represent, the interventionist streak that they have, is going to hold sway over where the president himself is.
How is Samantha Power going to be at the UN?
Well, I think she is going to be pretty high profile. I think, we have a long history of combative UN representatives on the left and the right, ambassadors rather. And I think, you know, I would be surprised if she doesn't fit into that mold. I think she's going to be a very strong voice there.
Will she have a tough time getting confirmed, Major?
So far, the indications are that she will not. I've heard some general reservations among Republicans. Can she be tough enough? Can she step into that role immediately? But those are low-level concerns. She's already has the support of John McCain. I talked to Lindsey Graham this week. He said he has no problem with her, would vote for her confirmation. It does not appear to be a problematic issue.
Interesting that Keith Urban, the former chief of staff to Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, tweeted yesterday morning, "Jean Kirkpatrick is turning in her grave right now. I don't know about you, but it might be helpful to have someone representing America at the UN who doesn't think we are the source of all the world's ills."
Well, I think there will be, she may get confirmed. I don't think it's going to be totally smooth sailing. I think she'll be challenged by Republicans who are concerned kind of about exactly that point, about what is her worldview? Where does she stand in terms of what does she think about the U.S. role in the world and what the U.S. role has been in the world in the past? So I agreed the John McCain endorsement this week was a powerful one because he's so respected in this area. But we've seen the proposed Secretary of Labor go nowhere, the proposed head of the EPA go nowhere. I think the confirmation in a second term can be tough, and especially when a president is battling a series of other controversies. You know, this surveillance controversy we talked about at the beginning of the show, it makes every other single thing President Obama wants to do a little bit harder.
Harder to get. Almost impossible.
Well, I don't want to predict she won't get confirmed. I just predict there's going to be something of a fight. And that tweet from someone who is a respected figure in that part of the Republican Party, I think, is a sign of that.
But I would also say there are times in politics where you make fights, and there are times when you have too many fights to make, and I think this might be where the Republicans have so many places where they can hold grievances against the administration. Samantha Power might be someone who finds her way to a slightly more simplified confirmation process, just because there's so many other battlefronts Republicans might find more useful.
Here's a Machiavellian thought, which is they would really like to fight against Susan Rice, right? Because on Benghazi, and they can't because it's not a confirmable post. So do they choose to wage more of a battle on Samantha Powers than they might have otherwise done so?
And if there were ever more evidence that the president considers Republican grievances about Susan Rice's role in the Benghazi talking points to be utterly meaningless, it is this promotion.
What about Samantha Powers, Susan Rice, and apparently Hillary Clinton, who all wanted the U.S. to go into Libya? Is that going to come up here?
Well, the question is how this affects now the debates over Syria. But at this, you know, the president had his view, they had their view, and the president prevailed. I suspect that is going to be the case once again. But they, I mean, you could see, and I'm not the foreign policy expert here, but you could see them arguing for a more interventionist stance in Syria than this country has and this administration has been willing to do so far.
But previously, President Obama overruled all his entire national security team, including Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, and David Petraeus at the CIA on the issue of how much you do for Syria. So I don't know that these new voices may have that same view. But as Karen said previously, that doesn't mean the president's going to change his mind.
Let's talk about the generals who appeared on the front page to the Washington Post yesterday, hearing these or presenting information to the Congress on sexual assault in the military. There was one female figure in that lineup. I thought that was sort of a curious way to come before the Congress on this issue, Susan.
It made kind of a point, didn't it?
It sure did.
These are the Joint Chiefs who are handling these issues of sexual abuse in the military and, by their own admission, not handling them very well. I read in one news account that it's the first time in modern history that the full panoply of the Joint Chiefs were at one hearing at one time to talk about one topic.
And that topic is whether or not they should continue this line of command in regard to sexual assault.
Right. Does the military have its wherewithal to continue in this political environment, the current situation, which is if you have a grievance, you have to bring it to your most closely ranking superior officer, and then they have a lot of latitude about what happens to that complaint and its adjudication. And Congress is very much of a mind to change that, and change that in very significant ways. And the military, looking at the statistics, doesn't have much of an argument to say that the current system is working, or that they have been sufficiently sensitized to the issue, and the military does have a history of training its way out of some problems it doesn't address historically. And given the opportunity, it has trained its way out of some problems. But it's been dealing with this issue for some time, and it's very hard to assert to members of Congress we're training our way out of this.
Especially if your commander is the person who's been involved in sexual assault.
But that witness table looked exactly the way it would have looked 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. What looked different was the other side of the dais and the number of women who are sitting on that Senate Armed Services Committee. So whereas you had somebody like Saxby Chambliss suggest that, you know, somehow hormones are partly responsible for this problem in the military, you had Claire McCaskill, a former prosecutor, saying, look, this is not about sex. This is about power and it's about violence. And she was backed up on that point by a Republican woman, Deb Fisher of Nebraska. And that is what is different about it this time.
But you wrote a piece this week saying that Republicans have not learned their lessons from the 2012 election on this issue.
Well, I was struck because at the exact same day that this happened, we had a conference at the Washington Post where the governor of Mississippi, when asked why it is that that's Governor Phil Bryant of Mississippi, was asked, why is it that this country is so mediocre with education? And he blamed it on women going into the workforce, which, if you look at the data, there are a lot of countries in this world where the they rank a lot higher, their school kids do, than ours do on any standardized test you want to give them, and yet they have a higher proportion of mothers in the workforce. So again, it's I don't know if it's that they don't know how to talk about these issues yet, or whether it's the actual mindset that needs to be changed.
And back to the point at hand with the military and the way it's currently structured, a commander can completely vacate a conviction.
And has done so.
I mean, vacate a conviction. So, and think about it this way. If you are in the military and you're a woman who has been harassed or abused, you have a sort of a couple of step process you have to go through mentally with within the confines of your own career. Do you bring this up? Do you invite the abuse that may come your way just because you've raised the complaint? And then you know the commander could vacate the sentence, even if you're successful. Does it create a climate of either predatory behavior? And it's not all throughout the military. It's worth pointing that out. And does it also create an atmosphere where those who have been abused don't want to come forth because they're afraid the system will work against them? Even if successful, things can be overturned. And that's what Congress is looking at most closely.
And let's talk about the IRS. They gave an apology this week for videos at those conferences that took place 3 years ago.
That's true, and that's an important point, that clearly there were abuses and a lot of misjudgment, millions of dollars spent in ways that look quite inappropriate. But they were in 2011, and that kind of spending has been drastically curtailed since then. However, easy to criticize the IRS. The IRS makes it pretty easy to criticize it, I have to say.
You bet. And
yeah, I think we can safely say none of the participants are primetime players.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's another tweet. If the government wants to know who I'm talking to, more power to them. If it keeps the country safe. And that's precisely the point, Susan.
That's true. And when you ask about issues like drones, you find real public support for it because it's a way to, Americans think, attack terrorists without putting Americans at risk. But that doesn't mean this won't be a controversy. I mean, Karen made the point that this may not be. You go out and talk to Americans about what they care about. They care about jobs, the jobs numbers that came out today. Is a health care plan going to work the way it's supposed to? Over issues like surveillance of phone records. But that doesn't make this an insignificant issue. I do think this is going to be a big one.
Americans also worry about why didn't they catch those guys in Boston?
Exactly. All right, let's look at the economy, which created more jobs than expected this
175,000 in the month, non-farm payroll increase, but the unemployment rate ticked up from 7.5 to 7.6%. People say,
how does that?
Well, what happens is, in this month, it's a classic illustration of it, when more people look for jobs, the larger the labor force, because participation is counted twice, in two ways, rather, not twice, but in two ways. Do you have a job, and are you looking for a job? And more people are now looking for a job, which economists will tell you is, generally speaking, a healthy sign.
A good sign.
That people think there is a better prospect for them to find employment. So what you have is a continuous month-by-month, not spectacular. We haven't had a spectacular month of job growth for quite a while, but we have persistent and within expectable or predictable patterns of job growth. And that's what the White House said about this morning. Not great, but good and solid upward trajectory.
Karen.
It does. It just, right, the more and more, it seems like every month is bringing us more statistics that suggest that the economy has now picked a direction, and it's not as fast as people would like, but that it's set and that the recovery is, in fact, here.
It also shows that some of the cuts in spending from the sequestration have not had the catastrophic effect that some people worried it would. And, you know, we lost some tax breaks on January 1st. There was concern that might slow down the recovery. The recovery seems to be, as you say, kind of modest but steady.
One thing I would say about sequestration cuts, there is some sense in the White House, certainly, and even among some Republicans on Capitol Hill, that by September, October, and if the sequestration cuts continue into the next year, the bite will begin to become larger, be more economically noticeable. And I don't think we've heard the last about the economic impacts of these spending
cuts.
What
about manufacturing? That has not gone anywhere.
Well, it hasn't leapt forward.
Right.
The auto industry is showing signs of consistent gains. There is some export growth in the economy, not nearly as much as the president and his economic team would like to see. And you see it in pockets of the country where their manufacturing incentives are being created by the state governments. But in the main, it is still a lagging element of
but
the U.S. economy.
There was one good bit in the factory orders numbers this week that they were pretty unimpressive generally, except for the fact that the orders for durable goods were up by 3.5%. And people watch that very closely because they see it as an indicator of how confident businesses are feeling and as they look beyond what's in front of them right now for their long-term planning.
And of course, you had President Obama going to North Carolina yesterday, talking about his plans to produce or increase interconnectivity.
That's right, to have more Wi-Fi, more broadband internet service at schools. It's something he's been talking about for months. I have to say it's something that doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but he does continue to talk about it.
Susan Page of USA Today, Major Garrett of CBS News, and Karen Temelty. The Washington Post. Short break. Your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at GatesFoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at JHartFound.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Syrian troops capture a key town with help from Hezbollah. Anti-government protests in Turkey continue. And President Obama meets with China's new leader. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. A number of people would like to remind us that the surveillance we are hearing about, reading about, seems Orwellian in nature. His novel, George Orwell's novel, 1984, was published 60 years ago, the exact date, June 8, 1949. So let's go to the phones here to Little Rock, Arkansas, and Erickson, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. This is my first time calling in. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go right ahead.
Well, I had a question about Mosquitian rights. And I remember one of your guests saying earlier that perhaps the Republicans have a problem with someone being at the UN who doesn't see the United States as some sort of number one country, gift from God type of thing. I quite think that would be possibly a good thing for the country to have, and maybe a different direction for us to start leaning.
What do you think, Susan?
Well, I think our caller is illustrating some of the debate that we may hear as this nomination goes forward.
Absolutely. To Hyattsville, Marilyn Samuel, you're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Diane.
Good morning, sir.
My thing is about the surveillance is that I feel like if you don't have anything to hide and you're not talking to terrorists or you're not involved in any illegal activities, my opinion is what is the problem if the government looking at your phone records or who you talk to? I don't know why people are paranoid about stuff like that.
What do you think, Karen?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who feel that way.
Yeah, and
I don't feel that way.
Paranoia is a separate issue, really, because all of these things must happen with the consent of the people. The government is doing things on behalf of public safety, and the public has a right to scrutinize the scope, the depth, the breadth of what is being done in their name for their safety. And the sticky wicket here is, if you talk to experts, they say, look, all right, as Susan indicated, this backpack bombing scheme in New York, it was foiled by this system. How was it foiled? Well, there was, as I indicated earlier, an email Dropbox that was related to a known terrorist suspect. It was flagged in a data collection. The dots were connected. It went to Colorado. It went to New York. It went back all through this analog process. All right. Now, disclosure of that process, showing how we did that, teaches those who want to do us harm things we'd rather not have them learn. Okay. And so that's where this problem arises in the public's genuine and, I think, legitimate thirst for knowledge about what's being done in its name for public safety, and those who are carrying out these programs revealing things that may be instructive to all of us, but similarly instructive to people who want to do us harm.
Back to the caller, we have a constitutional protection against unreasonable search and seizure. It doesn't mean you have a constitutional protection as long as you're not doing anything wrong. The standard in the past has been traditionally that you have to go to a judge and show there's some reasonable cause,
right,
to think there's a reason to look at what you're doing.
True.
Now in an age of terrorism and an age of high technology, some of those rules have changed and been redefined. I disagree with those who say if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't need to worry about the surveillance.
What about Supreme Court's decision regarding taking a DNA swab from the inside of your cheek if you are arrested for any reason at all?
And of course, the court decided that you could do that, but the dissents were pretty scathing.
That's right.
To my mind, it goes to the same thing. Obviously, it's not all one way or the other. There's a balance to be struck, and the debate that we're going to hear is about where should that line be drawn.
And quickly, Diane, on the search and seizure, absolutely, you have a constitutional protection against that. Those who would advocate on this data sifting would say it is not about searching and seizure. It's about collection of data. And if there is something that is legitimately flagged for investigative processes, then you have to go to court and obtain that second warrant to conduct a search or seizure type of activity under an investigative mandate.
However, we know that court has been bypassed on some occasions.
And the other criticism of the court is that it's been a rubber stamp for the administration. That the court in recent years has never denied a request.
All right, to John in Columbus, Ohio, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. How are you doing? There are some good topics brought up, and one of them is that right now a lot of people are worried about jobs and other things that don't do with privacy. And I think that this phone scandal comes to life is that what is the government doing while we're not paying attention to them? One of the things I know that they do, I used to work for a credit bureau that the Department of Homeland Security put a tap onto. They have direct access into the databases, and, it's like who controls when they're allowed to tap in there and what goes on with that.
Karen.
Yeah, the story we haven't talked about today is the Wall Street Journal's report this morning that the government has access to a lot of other data, including your credit card purchases.
And how does that switch flicked in this case of this caller? How, it's on, we're receiving data. Oh, now it's off, we're not. Who flicks it and why? What are the procedures? And what is the ongoing scope of all of that? And how comfortable are people with that general sense of the government on a basis that they're not fully aware of collecting, housing, and keeping data on their private lives?
I do think it is incumbent, and I don't think there is a national security problem. It is incumbent on the government to explain better why they are doing this and what they are getting out of it. But again, very often I think that administrations, Democrat and Republican, claim national security when they just don't want to have that conversation.
How much more is there going to be about this over the weekend? More disclosure, more information, more widespread collection of data that we don't yet know about.
Well, 48 hours ago, we didn't know about all of this. So who knows what we'll find out in the next 48 hours.
And Congress will be asking questions about this. There will be hearings and there will be testimony.
I certainly hope so. Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Chuck.
Hi. I have a question about the Affordable Care Act. A friend of mine has multiple medical issues, and she said that she's afraid that the government's going to have a lot of control over what she can, how she can be treated, what would be acceptable and what wouldn't.
There's an awful lot of questioning out there as to what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, how much you're going to pay. Go ahead, Karen.
There's a lot in the new law that encourages encourages science and the government and everybody else to discover which treatments actually work, which are really worth the money that we are spending on them. But at this point, at least, the law prohibits, for instance, Medicare from making actual reimbursements decisions based on that, which is sort of a lapse in logic here, but that sort of is where the law stands at this point.
Okay. And I want to ask you all about Frank Lautenberg, the oldest U.S. senator. He died this week. He was buried this morning. You had a story about him, did you not?
Oh, I think it was the other long-serving
okay. Well, I have a story about Senator Lautenberg at my 30th anniversary gala at the Mellon Auditorium. I got there a few minutes late because of traffic, and Senator Lautenberg was waiting for me, as was the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood. But Senator Lautenberg stayed there and talked to me about how important he felt this program was. And I was so touched. He was not in black tie, as everybody else was. He had come direct from Capitol Hill. And I shall miss him.
I must say my favorite Frank Lautenberg quote is that if one party is shameless, the other party cannot afford to be spineless.
And one thing I would point out, if you're trying to catalog Frank Lautenberg's importance in the legislative life of this country in the late 20th century, and you're pleased that you don't encounter smokers on commercial aircraft.
Exactly.
You have one person and one person only to thank. Well, principally, not only, because many people were involved in that legislation, but he was the quintessentially important driving force behind doing something which, when he first proposed it, was thought impossible, banning cigarette smoking on commercial aircraft. And he did it. And American aviation has been forever changed since. And as a non-smoker, I would say for the better.
And what do we learn about Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey and the politician he has chosen to sit in temporarily for Frank Lautenberg?
He's appointed his attorney general, his former colleague at a law firm, Jeff Chiesa. I hope I'm saying that name right. I've never heard of him before, and we may not have to pay attention to him long because he's not running for election to the seat he's been named to fill. This was such an interesting maneuver by Governor Christie. He pursued the opening in the Senate seat in a way that helps him but does not help his fellow Republicans win that seat.
Because Cory Booker, the mayor of
Newark,
is going to run.
He is going to run. There's some other Democrats who are going to run, too. But the fact that this primary comes up pretty quick and the special elections in October probably helps Cory Booker win that seat. There are some Republicans who are thinking about running. But the failure to get a consensus Republican named to that seat as an interim position doesn't give the Republican candidate the kind of launching pad that he or she might have had.
But it does give Governor Christie, in his reelection bid, a clean, wide-open field where he can run up a large, likely victory margin, which I no doubt predict, I can predict with certainty, if he runs for president, will be amplified as a way to suggest he runs strongly in a blue state and Republicans ought to take a serious look.
And now I want to welcome Congressman John Dingell to the program. Good morning to you, sir.
Well, Diane, good morning to you, and thank you for what you do.
Well, thank you for having now become the longest-serving member of Congress in this country's history. How does that make you feel this morning?
Well, it feels good, but remember that just serving in the Congress is a great privilege. We're the highest directly elected representatives of the people, and on top of that, it is the people's house. But more importantly, it is not how long, my dear friend, you serve, but it is how well.
And indeed, that is the case. However, there are an awful lot of people out there right now who do not think that Congress is working very well. What would you say to them?
I just say thank you for your friendship. Thank you for your help, because a lot of them have helped me to get here, and a lot of them have helped me stay. It's something that you remember, because they're helping me to retain, I think, perhaps the finest and most important job in the power and the hands of the American people.
I think Karen Tumulty has a story about you.
Yes, Congressman Dingell, this is Karen Tumulty, and I must say one of the most interesting and enjoyable interviews I have ever done in my entire time in Washington, which you may not even remember, was back in 1993. I talked to you about your father and how his service in Congress really shaped your view of what you were here to accomplish.
Well, I got to tell you, in all truth, Dad was one of the great influences in my life. And I remember the interview, and I appreciate your friendship. And I happen to know the good you do, and I thank you.
And Major Garrett.
Well, just one thing, Congressman. As you mentioned, it's one thing to serve a long time. You now have a untouchable place in American history. But I would also just point out to the audience who's listening, John Dingell was powerful before he had power conveyed onto him simply by seniority. He was a strong voice for a number of legislative issues. He knew the process incredibly well. As a matter of fact, if I can quote you, Congressman, you would often tell adversaries, you know, you work on the politics, I'll take care of the process, and I'll beat you every time. And frequently you won important battles, and there is a legislative history that you are a part of that I guarantee you historians will look at and admire for generations to come.
Well, you're very kind. The process, the fairness of the process is of exquisite importance. And knowing how to make it work is something. You can't be an effective legislator if you don't understand how this place works and how the rules function.
And Susan Page.
I'd just like to say congratulations, Congressman, and all best wishes ahead.
Well, God bless you. And thank you all. You're most gracious and kind, and it feels good. Now we're going to go back to work.
All right, sir. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations to you. Our love to your beautiful wife, Debbie, as well.
Debbie is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
I understand.
She is smart as a whip. She is loyal as a dog. She is beautiful as the spring. She is incredibly able, and she is very wise.
A good combination. Thanks again, and congratulations, John Dingell. He has now become the longest-serving member of Congress in our country's history. Quite an achievement. I've got a couple of callers here. I'm going to go to Newton, Massachusetts. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had just a quick question, sort of a bit, I guess, a pushback or just a challenging question about the idea of the mass monitoring of emails and phone records. One of your guests suggested that, well, if we show our cards to, you know, potential terrorists, then the terrorists will know how to get around those ways of being monitored. But I was going to argue the flip side, and I just want to see what you guys thought of this, that maybe it's like in urban centers, crime is down, And one of the reasons that, like analysts have said that crime is down is because that everyone's aware of how much more surveillance is happening.
Indeed.
Right. And what I was saying was representing the voices of those in the counterterrorism community who do have sensitivities about this. I was kind of speaking on their behalf. And I think there is ample room for conversation about this, and declassification of successful plots doesn't necessarily mean we're going to hand over the keys to our surveillance practices going forward. Every surveillance practice changes, every security practice changes, and I think the country, based on the reaction to these two stories, is hungry for more data, would like to know more about it, and the counterterrorism community, I think, is going to have to change its attitude about this particular
point. But just think about the Boston bombers. We would not have caught them so quickly if it hadn't been for those surveillance.
Public and private surveillance.
Indeed. All right, Major Garrett, Karen Tumulty, Susan Page, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations